Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. A new book by attorney, political commentator, and author Areva Martin has a word for women. The word is awakening. It's billed as a self-help book and feminist manifesto all in one, and she describes it as a call for action and gender equity, I should say, in a post-COVID world. Well, tonight we sit down with Areva Martin to talk about awakening ladies, leadership, and lies we've been told. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Areva, I'm so excited about having you on the program, I can't even get my mouth straight.
Hey, Harold, how are you?
I'm doing fine. You know, the last time I saw you was during the 2016 Republican National Convention. I think I rushed past you, my producer and I, and I kind of waved, and boy, has the world changed a lot since then.
Yeah, a lot has changed, and can you believe that we're going to be having another presidential election in 2 years? So, man, some big elections we shouldn't gloss over that are coming up in a couple of weeks in November, but yes, the world is moving very quickly.
I guess this is a buckle-up moment for all of us.
Yeah, you know, it's a buckle up moment, but it's also a waking up, open our eyes moment too, Harold. There's so much going on, and sometimes it can feel overwhelming, but we can't let the quick pace at which things are moving prevent us from slowing down and paying attention to those things that are really important. And of course, gender bias, racial bias, the things that hold people back, whether you're a woman or a minority. Those are things that are really important, and I hope people are taking some time to give some thought to how they are either being a part of the problem and hopefully a part of the solution.
I want to talk to you about all of those things, and a little bit of politics, too. Can't get away from that. But I do want to take a bit of a dive into this book, and especially, the subtitle, Ladies, Leadership, and Lies We've Been Told. Who's lying to us? And what do they say?
Well, sometimes it's the people we love. And the lies that I talk about, the five that I outline in the book, and trust me, there are more. I only got enough space for five, though. These are told to me by a lot of people that I love, including my grandmother and my godmother and women that helped to raise me, and they didn't mean them in a vicious way, so they weren't purposely trying to mislead me, but these were the lies that were told to them. So they were just passing on to me what had been told to them, and oftentimes that's, what happens. Women are telling other women what they've been told, so it's not meant with any kind of ill intent or maliciousness. It's just women for many, many years and decades and even centuries have been told a lot of lies because this system, this government, our society is patriarchal, and it's established by men, and men set the rules, and so men pretty much have told us what they wanted us to believe in. And so some of it we've rejected, but a lot of it we have bought into.
Give me an example.
First one in the book, one that was told to me throughout my childhood and young adulthood, is that your hard work is all that matters. Go into a job. Be the first one there. Be the last one that leaves. Take on every assignment. Just keep your head down and do the work, and your talent and your work product will be enough. It'll speak for itself, and you'll advance. You'll be successful. Now, Harold, that's a lie. You know that hard work is not all that matters in the workplace, and that in some workplaces, it may be the least important thing that you can do. There are so many other things that are important to getting ahead in the workplace. And oftentimes women aren't told about those other things. They really go into the workplace believing that they just need to work hard. Nobody talks about the old boy network or the subjective things like nepotism, things like favoritism that happened to cause some people to be super successful in the workplace and others not to be successful even when they work really hard. So that's one of the things I talk about. And I'm from the Midwest here. I'm from St. Louis. So I pride myself on being an incredible hard worker. It's you know, in my DNA. But I also want women to know in particular that we've got to go into the workplace with our eyes wide open. And although we should work hard, and this is not about telling folks not to work hard, but I want folks to know, women in particular, that there's some other things happening in most workplaces in addition to your hard work that you got to be keenly aware of to be successful.
Were you able to take the lie and essentially turn that around in your career, your successful career, the founding of Martin and Martin, your law firm? Or did you find yourself struggling with, dare I say, the realities of the lie?
I would say, Harold, in the beginning stages of being an entrepreneur, opening a law firm, yes, I was guided by the lie. I would go to work at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes I didn't leave home till midnight. Leave the office until midnight. I didn't get home until midnight. And I thought that everybody would come into that workplace and, you know, dedicate themselves and work as hard as I worked. I didn't realize that a lot of folks don't come to work to work. Many people don't come to work in someone else's business, you know, as hard as they are capable of doing. And that, again, there were some other things that I needed to be focused on in addition to just working those, you know, 14, 16, 18-hour days sometimes. So, yes, I was guided by a lot of what I had been told in my early stages of being an entrepreneur, and it took me, you know, I had to go through something. I had to learn the hard way. I had to go through some trials, some tribulations, and have some disappointments to really have a better understanding of how to be successful in the workplace as a young female boss, because there were some challenges that I wasn't prepared for.
We're talking to attorney, political commentator, and author Areva Martin. She has a new book out. It's titled Awakening. And you got to hear about this. Awakening Ladies, Leadership, and the Lies We've Been Told. If you have a comment, if you have a question for Areva Martin, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Certainly you may recognize her voice as a commentator on CNN and Headline News. That's where I was first introduced to her, on the tube. And she has certainly made a name for herself, not just in television, in legal circles, civil rights circles, but also as an author and commentator. You said you had to go through some stuff, some trials and tribulations. I thought I was going to have to pass the plate for a moment. but was there an aha moment for you in reference to at least this big lie about the working hard, about the reality that it may not necessarily be what you know, but who you know and how you handle that?
Yeah, I did definitely have an aha moment. And for me, again, as a young boss, as an entrepreneur, as someone who started a firm with one other person, and as we started to hire staff and, you know, having people work for me, I had an experience that taught me that I was working hard trying to get people to like me. I thought being popular, I thought being liked, I thought, again, leading by example, my 14 hours in the workplace, you know, staying at the office late, counseling employees and working on weekends, I thought all of that was what I should have been doing. And I had this revelation that it wasn't about being liked, but it was about being respected. And being respected required me to utilize some different skills. I had to learn some new skills. I had to put some new tools in my toolbox. And that required being a lot more transparent, being a lot more direct with people, setting expectations, making those expectations very clear, and then holding people accountable. And that's what I learned would cause people to work in the way that I needed them to work, to be productive, to be successful in my law practice. So, yeah, I did have that aha moment, and it changed the way I was as a manager. It changed the way I was as a boss, and it made my firm infinitely more successful, and it caused me a lot less anxiety, and I got a lot more sleep because I was able to go home and go to bed. I wasn't, you know, staying at the office till 12 o'clock at, you know, midnight. So absolutely, I had that moment.
Did you ever have a problem? I can imagine this for you, but did you ever have a problem speaking up for yourself?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. I write about this. I've written about it in articles. I've published it, and I write about it in one of my books. When I was a freshman in college, I was at the University of Chicago, very prestigious university. You know, I grew up in a housing project in St. Louis, and going into this all-white college environment was foreign to me. It was the first time I had been in an environment like this, you know, the brightest kids from all over the country, valedictorians, third and fourth generation college students, legacy students. I was what I'll call speech shamed by an upperclassman, a woman from a very affluent family in New York. She was a junior. I was a freshman. And she said she couldn't understand what I was saying. She said, "Oh, my God, what are you saying? I don't know. Whatever I would say." She just said my accent was so unintelligible to her. She could not understand me, and she embarrassed me and humiliated me so much to the point that I stopped talking for a whole semester. You know, I went to yes, no, and basically didn't talk. And I went and remade how I talked. I listened to tapes. I listened to folks. I got some books. I just changed everything about the way I spoke because. That experience. So I didn't feel comfortable speaking up for myself in that moment, in that situation, but I made that woman who had humiliated me. So I won her over. And what I said to her after I felt more confident that I could say something that she wouldn't embarrass me about, I said, "You know what? If you think I'm such a horrible example," basically she was saying I didn't belong there in so many words as I look back on it, I said, "Why don't you help me?" So I said, "Why don't you tutor me? Why don't you help me be the student that you think I should be?" And that woman became my English tutor. And she would take my papers. I would go over my presentations before her. She would critique them. She made me a better student. I ended up getting, you know, phenomenal grades at the University of Chicago. I graduated magna cum laude. So sometimes, you know, your enemy, you know, your hater can become your congratulator. And I had that experience with that woman. So, yes, I wasn't always confident enough to speak up for myself. That was something that I had to learn over time.
I do want to talk to you about that a little bit more. One could say that was at least one eye awakening. Okay. But you had a long way to go before you opened up the other ones. We're going to take a quick break, but don't forget you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on WHUR.com, including this discussion. You can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM, channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. The original Quiet Storm is next. That's on WHUR. I'm Harold Fisher. This discussion continues in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM, channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're talking to attorney Areva Martin about her new book, Awakening, Ladies, Leadership, and the Lies We've Been Told. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I invite you to tweet me at HFisherWHUR or follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. I spoke, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek just a bit ago about, you know, that incident at the University of Chicago could be one eye awakening. But it seems to me, based on that, you know, that story, that, again, as you said, that could have been, you know, an aha moment, an opportunity that you took to finally speak up for yourself, not to be shy. Why do some women still struggle with that? Is that another one of the issues that has kept them pressed down, one of those lies that you talk about in the book?
Here, I think women, many women are raised to be quiet. That they're told, you know, don't make waves, don't rock the boat, just be quiet and do the work. You know, this notion of don't toot your own horn, don't be braggadocious, don't, you know, let other people talk about you, let other people, draw attention to the work that you've done. And men aren't told that. Men are told, you know, if you do it, sometimes even if you don't do it, you know, talk about it like you did do it. It's like a different standard that men. And you'll see that happen in the workplace where, you know, the woman may do all the work on the project, but the guy sends out the email to the team saying, you know, I want to let you know about this tremendous success that we've had. And sometimes may not even mention that the woman was the one who did the majority of the work on it. My daughters talk about being on school projects sometimes with guys, and the guys expect the women to do the work, but yet they like to pipe up when it's time for the credit to be assigned. So women, again, are oftentimes socialized to be quiet in that way. I just had an experience. I just had this happen. I'm at the Congressional Black Caucus. I'm at an event with a bad sister who has a huge checkbook, who can write big checks as a sponsor of events. We're at an event. Her company has sponsored it. She's given a six-figure sponsorship, and she is supposed to speak from the stage. She's supposed to be acknowledged. And they, you know, some other folks did all the talking. They didn't acknowledge her. They didn't call her to the stage. And we're trying to encourage her to go up and, you know, take the mic. Let them know that you're the sponsor. And she was to do that, and she didn't do it. And we all said, now, there's not a snowball's chance in hell that a guy that wrote that kind of large check and is supposed to be recognized would not go and get his due, have his 2 minutes, his 5 minutes, whatever, on that stage. And not to say, you know, these are generalizations, not to say that every guy would have done that, but in that moment, it just felt like, you know, a guy would have been more assertive in that situation. And she didn't want to, you know, if the people were talking, she didn't want to interrupt them. She didn't want to seem rude. You know, there's nothing rude about it. Like, girl, you wrote the check. That's your moment. You deserve to be on that stage. You deserve to give your speech. You've worked hard. You've written this speech. You've gotten into this position that very few women of color are in, that have that kind of power in the workplace to drive the, you know, those kinds of significant dollars. But yet she decided to just sit on the sidelines. And she never gave her speech. She was never recognized properly. And I think back, that happened to me once. I put on a major conference for an organization. I did all the work. I raised some substantial dollars for this nonprofit. And I wrote a whole program, and I did not include myself in the program. And someone looked at the program and said, well, when are you speaking? I says, well, you know, I'm not going to speak. I'm going to let this person speak. And they said, what? They read me up and down and said, no way in the world are you going to not speak. And they insisted that I rewrite that program. So sometimes as women, you know, we're just used to doing the work and keeping our head down. And it's a new day. So I just want women to know the days of us keeping our head down and doing the work are over. And if we do the work, we should get the glory. Should not be shy about that.
I agree.
And if people don't want to give it to you, you sometimes got to stand up and take it.
Yeah. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking to attorney Areva Martin about her new book, Awakening Ladies, Leadership and the Lies We've Been Told. Jennifer, calling from D.C., thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, I agree with what she was saying, but I don't really think, I think we as women now, we know how to speak up more now than we did back coming up as kids. Or, you know, our parents always, like my mother, you know, she raised me at whatever you do, be good at what you do. You know, mind your manners, speak. So I agree with you. Women now need to take a stand because, like, we always give everybody else the praise or glory other than, you know, taking the credit ourselves for, you know, coming up with ideas. We'll come up with ideas, but then we'll stay on the back line instead of, you know, putting ourselves out there. And I guess that's how our culture was just, you know, taught to just, you know, like Sabrina said, we're working on a job, and it may be racist, but look, this is one thing they might say. Well, yes, this may be true about her not doing that, but she's always on time. Our work is done. You know, our work is set out for
yeah.
us. And you know what I'm saying?
I do.
And I think that has a lot with coming up. Like my mother, when she brought me up as the only child, but I had a father too. Her saying to me was, "Get, you know, excuse my language, keep your drawers up."
You know,
it wasn't about birth control
yeah.
or none of that, right?
But that, and that's you definitely had control over that, no question about it.
Yeah.
So, but so, Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing okay. with us. And but
can I get her name and number?
I'm sorry. Say again.
Can I get her name?
Well, it's Areva Martin, and as a matter of fact, you've seen her for years on CNN and as well as on Headline News. You don't have to be a news junkie like me to know. But, of course, she's also going to be at the Congressional Black Caucus weekend. But, yeah.
And, Jennifer, you can just follow me on social media, at Areva Martin. You can go to my website, arevamartin.com. I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah.
And that's okay. A-R-E-V-A Martin.
Well, Jennifer, thank you. A-R-E-V-A Martin. That's A-R-E-V-A Martin. Jennifer, thank you so much for calling. You know, she said something that kind of struck me. She talked about culture. And to that point, I do believe that there has been a huge cultural shift in the leadership part, particularly for women of color and black women. I mean, you know, we can talk about, the big names, Kamala Harris, Oprah Winfrey, Areva Martin, but even there are others whose names are not necessarily household names who recognize the cultural shift and step in. But you say that it's a call for action and gender equity in a post-COVID world. Why do you believe that COVID made a difference?
Well, COVID made a difference along with the worldwide protests that we saw after the murder of George Floyd. We started, first, a couple of things happened with COVID. The inequities in our healthcare system were on full display. We saw how African Americans in particular were disproportionately impacted by COVID. We saw how our healthcare system, was basically a dual healthcare system that favored white individuals over African Americans, particularly those living in marginalized communities. And we started having this conversation about dismantling systemic racism, acknowledging that there was racism in our healthcare system. And I said, let's take that conversation further. Let's definitely stay on this conversation about dismantling systemic racism, but let's also talk about those gender biases that also impact women of color, because we face two biases typically in our society and in the workplace. We face the race issue, and then we face the gender issue, and I wanted us to have that conversation. So I'm thinking back to what Jennifer said, too, in terms of what her mother taught her. I was in St. Louis at an Urban League event, and Zenona Clayton, 92-year-old Miss Clayton, she was road dog, ride or die to Dr. Martin Luther King. And when I posted a picture of her on my social media page, so few people knew Miss Clayton. They think of the civil rights movement. They think of the men.
Mm-hmm.
They, we know Rosa Parks, right? That's a household name.
Okay.
We know Dr. King's wife, Coretta Scott King. But there were so many women who were consequential in the civil rights movement, like Miss Clayton, whose names most people have never, ever heard of. And it's just another reminder of, again, the biases that exist in our system. And you could have someone like Ms. Clayton. I mean, if you Google her, her background, the work that she's done in the civil rights movement is so incredibly impressive as the men whose names we learn in history, whose names our parents talk about, whose names get, you know, repeated over and over again during Black History Month and other times when we talk about African American history. So those, you know, women like Zenona Clayton, 92 years old, you know, the peer of so many of those civil rights men that we revere in our community and in this country. So we've got some work to do, Harold, and I want us to have these uncomfortable conversations, because sometimes men look at me and say, wait a minute, you know, I've got women on my job. You know, my mother and my sister and the women, my wife or girlfriend, they're doing okay. And, yeah, we are doing okay despite the barriers. You name Kamala Harris. We can name Ketanji Brown Jackson. You know, we can call the roll, you know, Stacey Abrams, Keisha Lance Bottoms, so many women who have achieved incredible success in politics and in business. Roz Brewer, CEO at Walgreens. I mean, so there's a list of women who have achieved incredible things, but they've achieved it despite the barriers, just like African-American men, you know, who have accomplished. Barack Obama, you know, we can go down, Cory Booker, Akeem Jeffries. You know, there's so many successful people of color, but we do it despite having sometimes like feeling like our hands are tied behind our backs and shackles are on our feet. You know, we just plow through and get it done. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be looking at how we break those systems and those barriers.
Tell me another lie.
Women, you can't have it all. Choose. Have a family. I have a successful career. And never, Harold, you know this, has a man been told, CEO or father, CEO or dad. It's not even the conversation anybody has with their son. You know, tell your son, go out there and, you know, be an NBA player, be an NFL player, be the president, be a CEO, be a boss, be whatever you want to be, and have a family. But women are often confronted. I talked to women today who are just starting out in their careers, women in their early 20s, in their mid-20s. And that's one of the first questions they always ask me. How do you balance it all? How did you have a successful career and a family? I don't think a guy has ever asked me that question.
You know, I think you're right. A couple of weeks ago, I was at an event at the National Press Club, and one of the this was about older workers and all of the things. And when I say older workers, people over the age of 45, getting back into the workforce, staying in the workforce post-COVID. Mark Morial was there with the Urban League, Congressman Bobby Scott, and a lot of top-tier people from various and sundry backgrounds. And to your point, one of the panelists after the event, I was speaking to her. This was a white woman. She was not a black woman, and she made a comment about her ex-husband, where she was always the breadwinner, and she said in the more than 20 years that they had been married, he had only held a job for a total of 3 years. And that was one of the reasons why they were no longer married. And I think about what you just said about the expectations and whether or not, you know, the patriarchal thinking of husband being head of household and breadwinner, and then the woman being in a lower position to that. But again, women of any color, and particularly black women, who are, as you said, seeing some successes, but are they perhaps stained by the way of thinking that they would still expect a male partner, women, a male partner to be the, you know, at least, equally yoked as far as the gender roles? Or might they still expect him to be head of the household, to make more money? I mean, is it, are we all twisted up and turned around by that?
Well, let me say this, Harold. The patriarchal thinking and the patriarchal system that we have, it's like white supremacy. You know, we have all been raised in, a world where white supremacy is prevalent. And that means that even people of color sometimes may take on the thinking of white supremacists, right? Or the characteristics of white supremacy. Doesn't mean you have to be white to start taking on those characteristics. And we can think of some black people. You got to call it a role, but we can think of some black people. Say some things, right?
Whatever. Whoever do you mean? No, go right ahead.
Do some things, right? You know, some people sitting on some courts, right? That, you know, we could say that they, their thinking and their actions are more akin to those of a white supremacist. So I give that analogy because that's the same way as women. We grow up in this patriarchal society, so we also take on the characteristics and the thinking. And you'll hear a lot of women say, well, you know, but in my household, the man, you know, he's in charge. He makes all the decisions. He's, you know, and you go to black church and they tell you, you know, it's biblical. The man is the head. He's got to be, you know. So we get all confused by that. And it takes a lot to deprogram yourself from that. And that's what you really have to do. You have to step back and think, well, wait a minute. I don't think God decided that a man should be superior to a woman. Like, why? That's patriarchal. That's just playing into that same patriarchal structure, and system that we've all been, so inundated with. So you will often hear women say that. And all I can say is, grace. Give them some grace.
I like
and
that.
Love and understanding, because I know where it's coming from. I thought a lot in those ways, and I try to step back and make sure I'm not passing that on either to my daughters or to the women that I mentor, and I try to really make sure that programming. Look, I grew up in a hardcore hood of St. Louis, so the male, female, there weren't a lot of men around, you weren't a lot of fathers around, so all the way, that black women talked about black men, so it's a whole lot of stuff that happens to us as children. We
got
to deprogram ourselves from. So, I'd like to think that this generation and generations going forward, that we can disabuse ourselves of a lot of those thinkings of, like, the man has to make more than the woman, or the woman has to do the cooking and the cleaning, and the woman has to be the primary caregiver of the child.
Yeah.
Where is that written anywhere?
Yeah, and I think that goes back to the point that I was taking about, the cultural change, where, in some cases we do find not a lot, but I think a significant number of men who are doing some more nurturing, and where you do see kind of roles reverse. And I don't think there's anything, wrong with that. I mean, we had a story earlier today about a D.C. police officer who was off duty, and he was hit by an SUV in a shopping in a grocery store parking lot. But he was there with his mother shopping. And I think that, you could argue, well, that's what a man is supposed to do. He's supposed to love his mama. But that's the cop out. I think that you do have some men who are, I count myself in that number, who are a little more, nurturing toward the people that they love, whether it's their mother, it's their children, even their friends. Sometimes the brothers are the ones that a friend may call on before they may call on a sister, because in a given position, he may be more dependable. That he's going to move quickly if you need,
right,
if he needs to bring, two cases of water, or something like that.
And
but
it really really shouldn't matter, right? It's who you can depend on, whether it's male or female. And look at this, Harold. That whole concept, let's take that patriarchal to its extreme. Then we get over to masculine toxicity, right?
Mm.
And we see that in, you know, we've seen that on full display with Donald Trump. This notion that to be a tough politician or to be a tough leader, you've got to talk tough. You've got to, you know, break all the rules. You have to win at any cost. You have to lie. You have to cheat. You do whatever it takes. And some people saying Biden is, we're going over to our politics now.
Yeah, I was about to, but go ahead.
Right? That Biden is weak because he doesn't yell and curse and lie and, you know, talk, you know, like building walls and, you know, calling people names. So that becomes where you, if you take that patriarchal, you know, to its extreme, we end up with that male toxicity that has been pretty pervasive in our body politic over the last, you know, I'm not going to say it started with Donald Trump, but it was definitely amplified. And that becomes what strength looks like, right? People start defining that as strength. And that's not strength at all.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a difference between being a tough guy and being a strong guy.
And being a bully,
yeah,
right?
And being a bully, yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about politics, okay? You know, you're here for the CBC weekend. It's been, you know, 2 years, and now you've got, of course, you know, it's, you know, the fun, the parties, the think tank sessions are going to be there. But overall, what do you believe is the call for the CBC now moving forward? We have a very critical election. I always say every election is critical. But just from a historic political standpoint, you know, these midterms are going to be big, 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 big. Could be the biggest since Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House.
Yes.
What do you think is the responsibility moving forward for the Congressional Black Caucus as we move through this election season?
So this caucus brings together political insiders, right? The bubble, the people that work in politics, the academics, the nonprofit leaders, the business leaders, you know, folks who are here because they're trying to advance some legislation. They're lobbyists, or you know, maybe they're the business owners who again may want some piece of legislation passed. That's great, wonderful people, lots of great networking. But I think the biggest responsibility everyone at this conference has is to take this message back to the people who are not in this bubble. Because you and me and the majority of the people here, we are highly, you know, plugged in to what's happening in Washington, D.C., what's happening at our, you know, in our capitals in our respective states. But the majority of people, I'm particularly talking about, you know, black and brown people, they are highly tuned into their daily lives, going to work, paying their bills, educating their children, taking care of their mothers and their fathers and their loved ones. So they aren't thinking every day about this, you know, are we going to flip the Senate? Are we going to maintain our slight majority in the House? And what does that mean if we don't? So we've got to motivate folks to come to the polls, and the things that motivate you and me aren't necessarily the same things that are going to motivate people who are not, you know, who don't do politics for a living. So when we leave all these parties and all these great receptions and, you know, we get through with all of our, you know, networking, what do we do in our respective towns, our cities, our suburbs? How do we take the message and the inspiration we're getting here and spread the love? Because if we don't do that, it's all for naught. We can have the biggest party, we can pat ourselves on the backs and do whatever, all good. But if we don't convey that sense of unity, you know, the sense of purpose, the sense of, you know, hope that we are all feeling together over these last 3 or 4 days, if we don't take that to Big Mama and Pookie, you know, then we're going to be in a world of trouble in this country. So that's what I'm excited about. I'm excited about how we now all go home on Sunday and get to work. We can get to work. We got less than 6 weeks of time to talk to those voters who may be inclined to not vote, who don't think about these being, as you just said, you know, one of the most critical elections of our time.
Well, you know, I would say, just from my vantage point, I think, you know, the culture wars are polarizing, and I think everybody's going to be where they are on that, whether it's Roe v. Wade, the so-called CRT, and, you know, in our schools, which, of course, it's not being taught, and, you know, and it just ticks me off that, of course, you know, Black history is now seen as critical race theory when it's just, you know, it's just Black history. But that's another hour show. But the thing I think that is being missed, and I was thinking about this just today, where there was the announcement about this $20 million project, a bicycle and pedestrian bridge stretching from Southwest D.C. to Arlington, Virginia, and it's not going to be done until 2030, but the money is coming from the infrastructure bill that was passed. Those are jobs, and that's just one thing. And I think that you can talk about culture, you can talk about race, you can talk about all of these other things, but I think we're still not hearing the message from the Democrats about the trickle-down effect of this infrastructure bill and how folks are going to get employed.
And Harold, you said the Democrats. The Democrats are you and me, because what we know about, I don't like the word low propensity voters, but what I'll say, what we know about voters who don't vote in every election is that they are motivated to vote when they get the message about jobs from trusted messengers. And trusted messengers aren't politicians with slick ads on television or slick brochures that get mailed to their homes or robocalls or text messages. That's annoyance to most people.
Yeah.
But when you and me go into communities where people trust us and know us and we talk, like you just said, hey, dude, that project is going to employ thousands of people. You know, your cousin ain't been able to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a job for him from this bill. Don't worry about the bill, whatever it's called. Call it whatever you want. Build Back Better, whatever, and change the name a couple of times. What matters is how it's going to impact you on a daily basis. You can get a $27 an hour job. They're going to be hiring.
Yeah.
You can get a $30 an hour job. They're going to be hiring. They've got to hear that. That's why I said all of us got to leave this conference and we got to get to work, because we're those trusted messengers.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody blames the Democrats and say, well, the Democrats, you know, they're not good on messaging. They let the Republicans, you know, co-opt the message. But we're the Democrats. There's no, you know, no amorphous group called the Democrats. You know, there's a president. You know, there's some people who have titles. Yes. And they definitely have a job to do. But at the end of the day, it's us. I bet I can get more people to vote than somebody watching Joe Biden on television talking about that infrastructure bill.
Yeah, because they may not see your what you're sharing as political. They see what you're saying as brass tacks, because it's not just the project, but it's also the jobs that may come from that project. You know, whether it's the food truck that is going to be serving, you know, the workers on this project, or building, you know, some of these other things. Yeah, I mean, we could talk about that for a while.
They know me.
Yeah.
They know me. So they know I'm not going to come in and tell them something that's not true.
Yeah.
And they've watched me. So they know, you know, my walk matches my talk. So that's what we all have to do. We have to be the solution.
Yes, indeed. And that's going to be have to be the final word. Get both of those eyes open for awakening ladies' leadership and the lies we've been told. Areva Martin, thank you so much. Good to talk to you, sis. Enjoy
thank
yourself.
You.
Stay dry this weekend at CBC.
Thank you.
That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Friday, September 30th. For News Director Renee Nash, reporters Millett Green, Bramante Bryan, producer Candace Wilson, and engineer Bobby Adams, I'm Harold Fisher. Have a good night and a wonderful weekend.